We want to welcome with us the Pre-Law Society of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Would those students please stand? Welcome. You may be seated. If you don't have materials on this case, we urge you to go into the foyer, at least one of you, and get a description, a synopsis of this case. I think it will help you listen to it better. I don't know if you're going to be with us, but at noon there will be a presentation with Justice Bradley about the procedures of this court, not the substance of the case, which you're going to hear, but you're cordially invited to attend, and anyone else in the courtroom may also attend. Let me introduce the court to you. I've mentioned Justice Bradley. She sits to my immediate left, and to her left is Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And starting at the other end of that's me. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice.
What end is up? That's what we want.
And to my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Diane Sykes. My goal in life is to at least start the court day with the court smiling. So with that said, I'll now call the first case, which is 02-3348-CR, State versus Wright. Vetzner, Assistant State Public Defender, is at the microphone representing James L. Wright. Mr. Vetzner.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Bennett Vetzner. I represent the defendant appellant in this case, James L. Wright. This case is before the court on a certification from the Court of Appeals. The primary certified issue was whether Wright's challenge to his no contest plea was waived. Now, that issue had not been raised by the parties in the Court of Appeals. When the parties filed new briefs in this court, the parties essentially agreed that the challenge to the plea had not been waived. In light of the fact that there really is no dispute between us, even though that issue still remains before the court to be decided, I would intend, subject to questions on the waiver issue, I would intend to focus primarily on the substantive arguments about whether or not Wright should be able to withdraw his plea. My position on this issue is really pretty simple. Wright was charged and pled to an offense that required that he possess 5 or more grams of cocaine. But it's undisputed that he possessed less than 5 grams of cocaine. Ergo, as I said, in my very simplistic view of this, there was no factual basis for the plea, and the appropriate course of action would be...
Counsel, I understand the waiver argument, as I understand your client, he had 2.9 grams. And the difference here is that there is a different sentencing for 5 and more, correct?
Correct.
All right. So when you say there is no factual basis, there was no cocaine, there's no factual basis, or just that the plea was to something that he had not committed. In other words, over 5.
I would concede that there is, on the record, a factual basis for a conviction for an offense in requiring possession of
less.
any amount of cocaine, here in terms of the gradation, less than 5 grams of cocaine, yes.
All right.
Counselor, are you saying he can't plead to something that's not in the information? Is that your position?
No, I'm not saying that you can't plead to it, but ordinarily when you're pleading to a different offense, there's a factual basis for what you are pleading to. Now, there's one big exception to that, and that's the Harrell case from the Court of Appeals that was discussed in my brief.
Before you go on to that, I want to be sure that I understand your answer to my question. So you're not contending that because the complaint or the information that was then on file when he entered his plea was under 96141 CM2 rather than CM1, that there's a problem. So you're not worried about the paper that was there. Is that correct?
No, the problem is the facts.
Okay, so even if the paper were wrong, if the correct facts had been read at the time of his plea to him, it would be sufficient.
Well, I don't think we're talking about a typographical error here.
I understand that we're not, because the information was filed based on what they thought was then the correct facts in regard to the quantity of cocaine. It's not what I'm concerned about. What I'm concerned about is, can he plead to an information that states a charge of which he now says there are not sufficient facts to support it, or is it just the recitation of facts at the time of the plea? Is the paper the problem? Are the facts at the time of the plea the problem? Or are both the problem?
Well, in this case, I think it's that both are the problem.
So you wouldn't let him, excuse me, you would not, I'm sorry, hold this plea to be factually valid if the information is wrong?
Well, there's circumstances. I think that brings me back to the Harrell case. I'm not trying to avoid your question, but I think that's the big exception that makes it hard for me to answer your question yes or no. Under the Harrell case, if there's a factual basis for a particular offense, a negotiated plea can be agreed upon and entered validly to a different, lesser offense, even if there's no factual basis for that particular offense. And one example that I came up with in the course of the brief is, if there had been a factual basis for the charged offense of possession of 5 to 15 grams of cocaine, it would be possible under the Harrell case for there to be a valid plea, for example, to possession of marijuana, which is a lesser offense. In other words, if there's a factual basis for the charged offense, it's permissible for a plea to be entered to a different, lesser offense. The problem in this case is this isn't the Harrell situation. This is the inverse of the Harrell situation, where we have a greater offense and the plea's being entered to a greater offense.
But my problem is this. Was the plea entered in regard to what's in the information or in regard to the facts that were discussed about the quantity of cocaine that was in your client's possession?
Well, what the State's going to say is there's no way to answer that. That's the State's position.
Well, I want to know what your position is. I'll pick on the State when they get up there.
My position is that we look at what the charge is, not the penalty. And the charge here was possession of 5 to 15. That's what he was pleading to, and there's no factual basis for it.
And he was pleading to it because that's the only thing that was in an information at the time of the plea, correct?
And there was never any understanding reached that he was going to be pleading to a different, lesser offense. Those two points put together, yes.
Did the judge describe the charge in taking the plea?
Not as clearly as one would like in retrospect, but during the course of the plea colloquy, the judge stated, you understand that this offense is based on your possession of 5.9 grams of cocaine, to which the defendant said yes. And, of course, the problem is that we know, or at least it's been conceded by everybody, that there was not 5.9 grams of cocaine. It was less than 5, which has significance in terms of what the crime was.
Mr. Bessler,
the information has 5 plus grams. The description in the plea colloquy is 5 plus grams. The judge then tells the defendant the potential liability, the potential sentence. What does the judge say about that?
He says that the potential liability is 16 years as a maximum sentence.
And that matches what?
That would match an offense of less than 5 grams of cocaine.
So at least the judge knows that it's less than 5.
No, the judge doesn't know that.
And how does the judge arrive at 16 years max?
Because the defense lawyer says the maximum sentence is 16 years. The prosecutor does not disagree with that. But the defense lawyer also, in stating what the nature of the agreement was, never in any way indicated that the charged offense of involving 5 to 15 grams of cocaine was being reduced to a less serious grade of offense involving than 5.
So what we have here is the prosecutor is told to amend the information but fails to do that.
Correct.
Right? Defense lawyer, and maybe it's not the same defense lawyer, but at least the one that's at the plea colloquy apparently knows it's not 5.
I wouldn't agree with that. I don't think we know. We don't know what the defense lawyer knew.
So may have made an error, but at least by happenstance or otherwise got the right sentence, maximum sentence.
Yeah. One other possibility that I didn't really specify very clearly in the brief, in terms of trying to figure out what was going on in the defense lawyer's head, if you look at the information in this case, which was the last page of the appendix to my brief, it uses the correct statutory section number and makes reference to the weight, the supposed weight of the cocaine, but it never really specifies that particular offense involves 5 to 15 grams of cocaine. If you look at the plea questionnaire, which was the appendix to the state's brief, when the lawyer is supposed to list the elements of the offense, there's no reference there to the weight of the cocaine at all. It's possible that the lawyer in this case simply thought that the charge was, from the beginning, simply didn't understand what the charge was and thought that the offense here was the minimal offense involving less than 5 grams of cocaine without really even knowing where the cutoff was.
Mr. Vetzner, my question goes to what the judge did when he found out that there had been a mistake here. And basically, my understanding is they corrected the judgment of conviction to reflect the appropriate statute involving less than 5 grams. What's wrong with that? That seems to be a sensible way of handling this.
Well, there's the problem is that's not what the defendant pled to, that's not what the plea was entered to, and at sentencing, that's not what the understanding was of the offense at the time of the sentencing.
Well, isn't there an earlier proceeding where it's made clear, at least that was my understanding of the facts, it was made clear that the reports had come back that it was not 5 grams or more, that it was less than 5 grams. Isn't that a discussion that occurred at an earlier proceeding?
At what was primarily a bail hearing, the district attorney who was handling the case at that point informed the judge that there had been crime lab tests that came back that showed it involved less than 5 grams of cocaine and that was going to reduce the grade of the offense. The judge very appropriately said, well, then the thing to do is to file an amended information. That was never done. What nobody knows is who knew about the results of that crime lab report. One of the things that I pointed out in my brief is that the transcript where that statement was made was never, I should say, the hearing that where that statement was made was never reduced to a transcript until after the conviction and sentencing had taken place. Moreover, even after a transcript of this had been prepared, I think we should remember that Mr. Wright's first appellate lawyer completely missed this point also. Ironically, it's the Court of Appeals that certified this case for a supposed waiver problem. It was the Court of Appeals that first recognized the problem here. Nobody else seemed to be aware of the fact that this particular individual pled to an offense that the record didn't support and was sentenced for an offense that the record didn't support.
No one picked it up, Mr. Vetzner, because there has been no harm. He pled to an offense which was possession of a controlled substance with intent to distribute. Is that it? And that he was told what the maximum penalty was. And the maximum penalty fit the number of that we're talking about, right? The number of grams. So he knew he was pleading to an offense that involved cocaine, that involved a maximum of 16 years, and agreed to that. It's sort of irrelevant under those circumstances how many grams he had, as long as he knew what the maximum sentence was, and that this is just a technical problem with the information. And that he hasn't been harmed. And that his judgment has been changed so that forever onward, including his time in imprisonment, he will be known for having been guilty of the 2 point something or other grams, not 5 point something or other grams. So what are we complaining about? I mean, what, you know, you don't get perfection in the courts. We come close, but we don't get perfection. And to demand perfection will mean we'll retry again. And here you had a whole slew of people who, as you point out, did not see the flaw, even though he appeared several times, right? So what are you complaining about? Other than under the Constitution, you're entitled to plead to a charge that matches the facts. But what's 3 grams among friends?
I'd have two answers to that. First of all, in virtually all the cases where this court or the Court of Appeals or even the trial court has granted a motion to withdraw a guilty plea based on a lack of a factual basis, we don't really engage in a prejudice type of analysis. The very fact that there was a plea entered really makes it difficult to engage in that kind of process. But to the extent that we would engage in some kind of fairness or equity analysis, I think I would reverse the question. I think even Mr. Becker, on behalf of the state, would acknowledge that the basic rule when there's a claim of no factual basis, the ordinary procedure is to allow the defendant to withdraw his plea. The state's come up with 2 cases that where a different remedy was provided. Now, if we start with that as the basic remedy, I would take Chief Justice Abrahamson's question and switch it around. And I would say, how is the defendant gaining any special advantage if he were permitted to withdraw his plea? The fact of the matter is, if he withdraws his plea, the way I compute it, although everybody's had trouble with computing sentences in this case, that if he's able to withdraw his plea, he's going to be facing 25 years in prison as a maximum sentence. He's going to also, that's on the drug offense. He's also going to be facing 3 years in prison for the obstruction offense. he's going to lose the benefit of the plea bargain recommendation for probation on one count and no more than 5 years on the other count. And the fact of the matter is, many, if not most persons in Mr. Wright's situation would probably be instructing me that they don't want to withdraw their plea. Now, what about the state's position? Is the state going to be facing any harm if Mr. Wright is permitted to withdraw his plea? The fact of the matter is, at least in this particular situation, we've got what is a two-witness case from the prosecution standpoint. It would be Officer Falk, who was involved in arresting Mr. Wright, and that whose testimony, by the way, has already been preserved at a preliminary hearing, and we'd presumably need somebody from the state crime lab to testify that the substance that was obtained was cocaine, and, of course, the elusive question as to how much cocaine was involved. This is not a situation where the state, in reliance on the original plea bargain, tossed away all kinds of evidence and all kinds of witnesses back all over the world. This is a situation, in these particular facts, where it would be just as likely that Mr. Wright would be asking for resentencing, which is the remedy that the state is really saying is the appropriate remedy here. It would be just as likely that Mr. Wright would be seeking resentencing, and it would be the state that would be saying, uh-uh, if Mr. Wright isn't satisfied with what he's got, the ordinary remedy when there's a lack of a factual basis is to withdraw the plea, and that's what should be done in this particular situation.
But, Mr. Vetsner, the next case may not have such good facts for the state. Next case, you may not have the witnesses. They may be all gone.
Well,
evidence may be gone. How many years have elapsed now on this case?
Close to five.
Close to five. It's a long time. So this court has to look at future cases, because maybe you can say, okay, we'll do it only if the state's not harmed. Is that your position?
Well, my position is that it's not – back up for a second. The state's able to point to two cases where the remedy was resentencing rather than withdrawal of the plea. I don't really go along with their analysis, but as long as there's at least two cases, it suggests that there's at least some flexibility, some room to deviate from the ordinary remedy of withdrawal of the plea. And what I look at is a case that I think should be helpful to this court in deciding that kind of situation is State versus Robinson, 249 West 2nd, that was cited in my brief, although in a somewhat different connection. In that case, this court was asked to decide let me briefly sketch it out. That case involved a plea bargain with two counts. And one of the counts was messed up, and that count had to go out. What the defense wanted to do in that case was just have that count go out and have the other count stay the way it was, because the defendant got a real break on that one and didn't want to lose the benefit of the plea bargain on that case. And what this court said is the ordinary remedy when there's something that went wrong with the plea agreement or the resulting convictions, the ordinary remedy would be to withdraw the entire plea, that it's all one package, all the counts go. But the court also said that we should take a case-by-case approach to decide what the appropriate remedy is, looking at the totality of the circumstances. And then the court basically went through exactly the analysis I went through and said, okay, the ordinary remedy is it's all a package, it all goes out. Is that unfair to the defendant to use the ordinary remedy under the particular facts, under the totality of the circumstances of this case, and said, no, that wouldn't be unfair to the defendant? And then the court said, well, would this in any way be unfair to the prosecution if the whole plea agreement went out? And the court analyzed the facts and said, no, that wouldn't be unfair either. So I would suggest that to the extent that Chief Justice Abraham is suggesting, in some situations, it would be unfair to the state for withdrawal of the plea. That would be a circumstance that could be considered in deciding what to do. I think it's significant that with all the arguments the state has attempted to come up with in this case to prevent withdrawal of the plea, there's not one word in the state's brief suggesting that it would be prejudiced or harmed in any way if Mr. Wright were permitted to withdraw the plea.
Mr. Vetzner, on July 21st, when the prosecutor acknowledged that there wasn't as much evidence as thought, who was the judge? Who is the court at that point?
My recollection is that it was Judge Bastianelli who was the judge who continued presiding in the case at both the plea and sentencing. But I certainly can't fault him for not remembering that.
So there were two people consistently through this who ought to have known what was going on, the judge and the defendant. What does the judgment say? Who signed the judgment, and what does it say on the judgment?
Well, I don't recall whether Judge Bastianelli signed the judgment or whether his clerk signed the judgment, although it just as a practical matter, the preparation of the judgment is really a clerical matter, more or less, and I don't know that the judge pays much attention to the judgment. The original judgment provided for the greater offense, the sub 2 category, 5 to 15, and then, as we well know, as a result of the post-conviction proceedings in this case, that judgment was amended to the lesser offense involving 5 grams or less, the sub 1 offense.
I'm not sure I understood your answer to an earlier question. Why can't we just amend the judgment? And because that seems to reflect what actually was going on.
Well, I guess we could say if
the defendant knew, the penalty is changed. What's wrong with just amending the judgment?
What's wrong with amending the judgment is because that it's not the offense that the defendant pled to. It's not the offense that was understood to be the underlying crime at the time of sentencing. The plea was no good. The sentencing was no good. If somebody pled guilty to first-degree murder, but for some reason they said the maximum penalty is 20 years, and then the person were sentenced in the belief it was first-degree murder and got 20 years, and then lo and behold, during the course of the appeal, it was pointed out, hey, nobody died. It seems to me there's more involved than just saying, well, let's amend the judgment. Just make it attempted murder or injury by reckless conduct. The whole proceeding was flawed in this situation. As I've tried to suggest, there's absolutely no prejudice to the state in doing this, and there's no unfair benefit to the defendant in doing this. Accordingly, in conclusion, I would urge this court to vacate the judgment of conviction and direct that the defendant be able to withdraw his plea. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vetzner. Assistant Attorney General David Becker, representing the state of Wisconsin.
As the Chief Justice has just indicated, I'm Assistant Attorney General David Becker, and I'm appearing here on behalf of the state. Mr. Vetzner began his argument by putting forth what I think, if I got the word right, I didn't write it down for a minute or two after he said it, I think he talked about a simplistic view of the case. And I too have a simplistic view of the case. It is simply this. There's absolutely no question that the defendant here pled guilty to the crime of possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver, the controlled substance being cocaine. There's absolutely no question that he was, in fact, in possession of 2.9 grams of cocaine. That would put him under the statutory provision that provides the penalties for possession of cocaine with intent to deliver and provides the penalty for possession of 5 grams or less. Before this case ever came into the appellate, before this present appeal came up from the denial of the post-conviction motion, the judgment of conviction in this case was amended to reflect that, in fact, what he pled guilty to was possession of cocaine with intent to deliver in an amount of less of 5 grams or less. Even more critical, at the time of sentencing in this case, the understanding of the judge who sentenced him was that he was to be sentenced under the penalty for possession of cocaine with intent to deliver in an amount of 5 grams or less. As I pointed out in my brief, that was made clear at the plea hearing. Everybody agreed that that was the appropriate penalty. As I neglected to point out in my brief, during the course of sentencing itself, the judge said, you're facing a maximum sentence of 16 years. The maximum sentence of 16 years was the maximum penalty for possession of cocaine with intent to deliver in an amount of 5 grams or less. So he was sentenced under the appropriate penalty. His judgment of conviction before this present appeal entered the system has been amended to the appropriate penalty for 5 grams or less. The judgment of conviction before this case entered the appellate system the second time was reflected that that was the nature of the judgment of conviction. And I take then the very simplistic view of where is, as I think Justice Abramson said, where is the harm to the defendant? And I to perhaps tie it more to what's ultimately at stake here. We're talking about the withdrawal of a plea of no contest. And the ultimate standard for withdrawal of such a plea is there must be a manifest injustice. And we know that one of the forms of manifest injustice is no factual basis for the plea. But I want to go back to that fundamental standard and ask, where is the manifest injustice here? There's no question that the defendant understood that he was pleading to the offense of possession of cocaine with intent to deliver. There's no question that there is a factual basis for believing that he had 2.9 grams. And that's precisely what he has been convicted of. And I fail to see where the manifest injustice is.
Mr. Becker?
Yes.
I think it's arguable that a system should not be permitted where you plead to one offense, which has no basis of fact. And here, nobody's challenging that. You bind that person to that plea. I agree about the sentencing issue. And I think that it's arguable that we shouldn't have a system where a judge, without notice to the defendant, changes a conviction without notice or a hearing. Now, we have to worry about the system as well as this individual case. And what happens on cases is you start out with a case where, oh, it's pretty clear here. He knew it was 16 years. He knew he had the cocaine. You got a lab report. You got him caught with it. Got police testimony that's clear. And he's sentenced within the max. The next case, you're going to start chipping away at those facts and have it to where do you end on this? It seems to me you ought to say DAs ought to charge what the facts are, amend information. Judges ought not to change sentencing or convictions without notice.
Well,
sounds like a good system to me.
Well, but I think it's that system that you indicated we couldn't have without creating endless retrials. That's the perfect system, and the perfect is always the ideal. And the question is, what do we do when we haven't lived up to the perfect? And it seems to me in this particular situation, what we do is we recognize that we have a valid plea to possession of cocaine with intent to deliver. And we know how much he possessed, and that's precisely what we have convicted him of. But let me back to your original premise about changing a judgment of conviction without notice. This judgment of conviction was changed in response to the defendant's motion to withdraw his plea. It was at that hearing that was held on that motion that the judge said that, I don't know if the defendant agreed, but the prosecutor certainly agreed that we have to amend it.
Evidentiary hearing?
No, it was not an evidentiary hearing, but we knew what the facts were. I don't think there were any facts in dispute at that hearing. So this wasn't a question of the judge's willy-nilly, changing a judgment of conviction. It was the judge's response to the defendant's contention that there was no factual basis. And since everybody for that next tier up of in the penalty structure, and so the judge says we have to amend the judgment of conviction to reflect what we know was the true facts of this case.
Counsel, even if there was notice, I want to take a variation on that theme. This is in the back of my mind, a case that we had, and I think I was the dissent. So don't cite that as authority, of course. But I think we had a plea questionnaire. The defendant filled out the plea questionnaire. But the transcript, when you have the actual plea hearing, lo and behold, the judge never asked the defendant how he pled, and the defendant never entered a plea of guilty. And as the dissenting voice, I just thought, well, you know, there should be a level beyond which we don't go. I was a little concerned that someone would be convicted without pleading guilty. I just thought that, you know, in our system we should have, how do you plead? I plead guilty. And so you shouldn't be convicted without that. But, you know, it wasn't all that simple. That's the way I saw it. But it wasn't all that simple. You know, he did sign a plea questionnaire, and I think the majority said, you know, that was appropriate. But I have that same reservation here in terms of beyond this we shouldn't go. You know, at least you had a charge with five or more. The judge did a really nice job at this sentencing hearing and explaining the nature of the offense, and he talked to the defendant, and I think he must have been reading the information because he had a lot of detail. And he said, and you understand, I'm paraphrasing, the nature of the offense includes the charge of five or more, of 5.5. So he said that to the defendant. Now, when he gave the potential penalty, he gave the potential penalty under sub 1. When the question was asked of how do you plead to the charge, that relates to the charge under sub 2. So he was charged under sub 2. He pled under sub 2. When the court made its factual finding, as the court has to do, you know, circuit court has to say, I find a factual basis exists for the charge, and the judge did that. He said, I find the factual basis exists for the charge based on, he said, the complaint, which is sub 2. So I looked at it and I said, look, you got a charge with sub 2, you got a plead with sub 2, you have a factual finding based on sub 2, you had it explained to the defendant that the charge was sub 2, that is, I'm referring to more than 5. So if he was charged with it, he pled to it, the factual finding was based on it. I mean, and now we find there is no factual basis for that charge. Why isn't that the subject of manifest injustice? Why isn't that? When you enter a plea, shouldn't there be a factual basis for the plea? The judge found the factual basis, and it was erroneous. So that's the problem I have with the system.
Except I don't think there's a manifest injustice when there's a factual basis for the when he pled to an offense, possession of cocaine with intent to deliver, and everybody agrees that there was at least a basis for less than 5. So he pled to at least that. He may have pled to more, but if he pled to more, why doesn't that encompass what is so unjust about saying that that encompasses the slightly less? We're only talking again about the penalty figure. We're not talking about any of the and I don't want to get into an argument about labeling things elements offense and labeling penalty factors. We know that whatever you label them, they all go to the jury and they all have to be found beyond a reasonable doubt, and there's no dispute about that. But the point is we have a freestanding offense of possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver, in this case cocaine, to which he pled guilty. And the only thing we're worried about now is the question of the appropriate penalty and the amount as it affects that appropriate penalty. And it just does not seem to me, if he did plead to 5.5, and in my brief, of course, I say the record is hopelessly ambiguous. I'm fairly convinced on the basis of this record, pretty convinced, that defense counsel certainly knew that it was less than 5 grams, because I don't know how he could have come up with telling the judge the penalty is 16 years.
I think you're right.
And you can't do that by going to the statute book and say, well, the penalties got switched all around, because if you look at the penalties, the changes in the penalty between the time the defendant committed this crime and the time of sentencing, the penalties actually went up. So it would have been actually greater than the original penalty, would not have brought it down to 16 years. For that second tier
I agree with you. My best guess is the judge didn't have a grasp of that, because the judge specifically said the 5.5.
Well, I think that might be correct. But going back to the defense counsel had a grasp of it. I think that he shared that and that he put that penalty in the plea questionnaire. I think he shared that with the defendant. But I. As far as I'm concerned, the record is hopelessly ambiguous on what the defendant knew. I think defense counsel probably shared that with him. If that were ever an issue in this case, well, I guess it is an issue in this case, but it hasn't been established what the defendant really thought he was pleading to. I think the defendant had the burden to establish that if he's claiming there wasn't a factual basis for what I was pleading to. Well, tell us what you were pleading to, or at least tell us and go beyond tell us.
Yet
and prove
here the
us.
Judge went on at length telling the defendant what he was pleading to.
A page and a half. Yes.
And it was the 5.5 he told him to, or 5.
There was a brief reference to 5.5, and that's why I say hopelessly ambiguous, because was that what the defendant had in his mind, or had the defendant just come off of a discussion as part of filling out a plea questionnaire where the proper penalty for less than 5 was laid out with his attorney, that you're being charged with less than 5, and the defendant more or less let that 5.5 reference blow over his head because he knew the critical thing from his perspective is what is the penalty, and the judge had recited the proper penalty for the less serious penalty for the smaller amount. So, but I will also say this in response to your question about, is there a manifest injustice here? If you want to put the label manifest injustice on this situation, fine. That's what the court did, what this court did in White. It did say there's a manifest injustice, but it also said that the manifest injustice, in that case we had theft, very analogous situation with the penalties for theft turning on the amount, the value rather. Here we have a possession of controlled substance situation where the penalties turn on amount. I cannot conceive of those two situations not being interchangeable in terms of the approach we should take to these kind of defects. And what did this court say in White? The manifest, when it turned out there was not a factual basis for the amount that put, or for the value that put the defendant in a particular category of penalty, the manifest injustice in this case does not arise from the acceptance of the guilty plea to the theft charge. Precisely the same thing can be said here. The manifest injustice in this case does not arise from the acceptance of the guilty plea or no contest plea to the possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver charge. It arises, this court went on to say, from the imposition of a penalty based upon the conclusion that of the trial court that the value of the chainsaw at the time of the theft was $150. The trial court committed no error when accepting a plea of guilty to a violation of the theft statute, because a factual basis was established for actual theft. The difficulty presented relates to the imposition of the sentence. And I say to you that language all applies in this case and fits this case to a T. The problem arises here. It doesn't fit this case to a T, because the problem that arose there was the imposition of a penalty based on the fact that that amount, that value had put him in a particular penalty range. Here, we don't even have, we have even less of a problem because of the fact that everybody was operating under the appropriate penalty for the less than 5 grams amount. So if there is any problem here, it would arise from the imposition or of a penalty or based on a belief that he fell within the higher penalty range, which, like I say, didn't happen here. But that's the only possible problem we could have. And then what this Court said in White is, how do we deal with that problem? We deal with it by resentencing under the appropriate penalty. Well, here we don't have to worry about that because the initial sentencing was under the appropriate penalty.
Mr. Becker.
So White is absolutely pellucid in terms of what the appropriate penalty is in this case and makes it absolutely clear that the defendant has gotten everything he's entitled to in this situation, even if you want to label this a manifest injustice because of the nature of the manifest injustice, which
is a
remedy.
There is a reference in your brief to a quote from the Court that cites 943.21a in the White case. Did there have to be any amendment in a judgment from 943.21a?
Are you talking about in the White case?
Yes.
Well, there would not have had to have been any amendment of the judgment from that in White because if you're on page 13 of my brief, are you? On page 14 of my brief, I quote further. And there it indicates that the penalty structure and the penalties are set out in, or at that time where I guess they still are, 943.23. And they said in that quote, that second quote from White on page 14 of my brief, they said the sentence imposed pursuant to 943.23b, so that was the greater penalty, potential penalty, because the value was thought to be 150, but it really turned out there was no factual basis for that belief, is set aside and vacated. The cause is remanded for imposition of a sentence pursuant to the provisions of 943.23a. And all I can tell you is I think what I said in my brief, in a very brief reference to this problem about amending the complaint, and that is anybody in disagreement with the notion that if the remedy is to now sentence him under the appropriate penalty provision, or if the remedy in that case was that it just follows as the night the day, that we're going to amend the judgment to reflect the appropriate penalty provision. So in this case, we will amend it as we have from a sub 2 to a sub 1. Or in White, is there any question that when the judge got that back, while the Court didn't specifically address it, when the Court got that back and he now sentenced him as he was instructed to do under point 23A, that he then, when he entered his new judgment of conviction, he amended it from the point 23B to the 220, or point 23A? I mean, is there, nobody could argue about the propriety of doing that. If I am right on, as White teaches us, the appropriate remedy is resentencing. It just, as an adjunct to that resentencing, you obviously would amend the judgment of conviction to reflect the sentencing provision under which you now have, you're now sentencing him. I can't be a dispute about that.
May I ask you, does this case have anything to do with waiver at all?
I think not. But part of the reason I think not is because of my initial argument that I did not want my initial argument that I actually believe, and that is this case is hopelessly ambiguous as to what the defendant thought he was pleading to. And I think an absolutely fundamental foundation for a waiver argument, I gather the waiver argument that the Court of Appeals is suggesting is that he waived his right to complain about his conviction of possession of cocaine with intent to deliver in an amount of more than 5 grams. A fundamental foundation for such a waiver argument would be that he, in fact, pled to more than 5 grams. And since my whole first argument in my brief is the record is hopelessly ambiguous with regard to that, and I truly believe that. I mean, it's not one of these where I felt like I could argue in the alternative because I didn't think I could offer that foundation that would be needed for a waiver argument, namely that he pled to more than 5 grams and therefore should be viewed to have waived any contention that there wasn't a factual basis for his plea because this was pursuant to a plea agreement. So I don't think in this particular case, I understand the Court's concern, and obviously it appears from their certification that they are looking for a case where we can maybe find some waiver in some of these situations where the courts are getting bogged down with attacks on guilty pleas. But I don't think this is the – I mean, it's obvious from the position I took in my brief that I don't think this is the case to do it. And so I have not argued waiver, and I don't think that waiver is involved here.
Counsel, we don't often take cases where the record is hopelessly ambiguous. Should we improvidently grant this case?
Well, I don't know that the record being hopelessly ambiguous is any grounds for indicating or for remanding it on the basis that it was improvidently granted. I suppose there could be an argument that since the main issue that it was certified on was waiver and there's no waiver argument being made, that sounds like a pretty good reason for saying that it was improvidently granted. But we're not suggesting you should do that, and we're not suggesting that, I think, for two reasons. Number one is look at the time you have invested in this case, including an hour this morning in oral argument. It seems to me, in the interest of just simply judicial economy, it makes sense for you to proceed to decision on this case. The other reason why I think you should keep this case, Mr. Vetzner hasn't gotten into this morning. Maybe he will in rebuttal, although he's not supposed to raise new arguments on rebuttal, but I guess I'm now raising it, so I'm opening the door to him to do this. But he suggests, and I guess it wouldn't be a new argument, because he would respond, I guess, to my reliance on White, which I've relied on heavily here, quoting from the decision, and say, White doesn't survive Apprendi. And so I think this case presents a good vehicle for you to decide whether or not White survives Apprendi.
And that's the argument that you said you weren't going to make, or at least part of it, that you weren't going to get into what's an element and what's not.
Exactly. That's what was there in the back of my head that prompted
so,
that.
Yeah. And that's the distinction that might be made here between White and this case, because you're not going to say this is not an element. Because it is an element that the jury does get.
Yeah, but that was true in White. I mean, White referred to three earlier decisions of this court that made it absolutely clear that questions of value are, A, questions for the jury, not for the judge to decide at sentencing, and B, are questions that are have to be determined using the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. In that regard, Wisconsin law at the time of White was fully consistent with Apprendi, which says that. And Apprendi, like myself here this morning, does not get hung up on whether or not you label something an element or a penalty factor. What they say is, bottom line, regardless of how you label it, you have to submit it to the jury, and it has to be found, the existence has to be found beyond a reasonable doubt. And so I am saying I prefer to continue to label in theft the elements of theft as elements and the value as a penalty factor. And I prefer in this situation to label all the elements, the possession with intent to deliver, the knowledge element insofar as there's one, the nature of the substance and all of that, I prefer to label as elements, and I prefer to refer then to the amount as a penalty factor. But there's no magic one way or the other. The critical thing is, does Wisconsin law treat them both the same for purposes of what must be submitted to the jury, what must be found beyond a reasonable doubt? Wisconsin law clearly does. It did at the time of White, and therefore I don't think Apprendi offers any basis for suggesting that White is in any way called into question. We can continue to label these things any way we want, just as long as we know that those labels don't have any substantive effect on what goes to the jury and what must be found beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, and neither of those issues have anything to do with what constitutes a sufficient factual basis for purposes of a guilty plea or a no contest plea, whether the issue goes to the judge or jury,
no,
or whether it's submitted
no,
to...
No, and more precisely has, I don't think, any relationship to the more specific issue that I'm invoking White for, and that is, assuming that you don't have a proper factual basis, what is the remedy? It doesn't go to that either. No matter how you label it, the fact is White teaches us that when it simply is what, let's call it an element, if insofar as it's an element that sets the penalty, or sets the range, sets the penalty, the way we remedy that is not to withdraw the plea, allow the defendant to withdraw the plea, but rather resentence him under the appropriate penalty. And I did interrupt you, I'm sorry.
That's all right, because on that issue of remedy, would you take a crack at reconciling White and this case to the extent that it's analogous with White and State versus Johnson, a case near and dear to my heart? State versus Johnson was the carjacking case in which this court vacated the conviction on the basis of no factual basis for the guilty plea to armed robbery because the element of aspartation was missing. It was the case
Glad you refreshed my recollection. I have a copy of Johnson here with me, but I was got a copy of a lot of decisions. I can't remember them all. But you're right, Johnson. But Johnson. I mean, the simple answer is that aspartation doesn't go is not. And now I'm going to go back to revert back to the label that I like to use in this context. That was not a penalty factor. That was one of the elements.
Well, except the offense that he was guilty of was attempted armed robbery, and that cuts the penalty in half. So in a sense, it was only an issue of penalty and the label on the offense in the judgment of conviction.
Well, but, in that case, though, we're talking about two completely separate and distinct offenses. I mean, you're right, you said that it was originally a...
It was an armed robbery. Carjacking. The defendant puts a gun to the victim in the car, orders him out of the car. He gets out of the car. The defendant can't get the car moving because it's cold, and this is Wisconsin, and couldn't move it. And he was charged with armed robbery, pled guilty to armed robbery, convicted to armed robbery, sentenced, and it constituted only an attempt because of the lack of movement of the car. And so he was guilty of only an attempt. There was only a factual basis for an attempted armed robbery, which would have cut the penalty in half.
Oh, and so
this court vacated the whole conviction.
But were they even first of all, I do think that is a distinguishable situation because, I mean, maybe it's, you know it when you see it, but aspartation does not sound to me like a penalty factor, even though what you're saying is, well, I think you're trying to make it a penalty factor by saying, okay, with the absence of aspartation, then all we had was an attempt, and that reduces the penalty. Well, that doesn't sound to me like a penalty factor, even in those circumstances. But the question I have, though, is I don't think, and I think I reread Johnson in preparation for the argument, I don't think that the court was ever presented with this argument, was it? I don't know.
Penalty versus elements?
Yeah. And if they had, I think we would have rejected it because it was not a
Mr. Becker, whether it's a penalty or an element, then becomes an issue of how counsel phrases it. Because we all agree that it has to go to the jury, and the jury has to find it beyond a reasonable doubt. And you want to just stay away from elements versus penalty, because that's a construct. And your argument here is that where the defendant pleads to more, a crime that is a greater crime, but it encompasses the less, he or she should be held to a plea to the less.
Well, you're talking about what I said this morning?
Yeah.
I don't take that further than I meant it. I mean, I always read my arguments in context, including my arguments in the brief. I was simply talking about more in terms of the penalty factor. Now, you're right. I suppose that potentially opens the door to other expansions on that down the road, perhaps. Even in a Johnson situation, it would open the door to some sort of an argument that about lesser included offenses and that kind of thing. But I don't think that that's any basis at this point for refusing to recognize, for simply adhering to White. I mean, this problem exists presently in Wisconsin law as a result of, I'm not taking this case beyond White. In fact, this case, like I say, is even a less of a problem than White because we had the guy sentenced under the right penalty.
Not today, but the case will come up next month.
Well, I don't know whether it'll come up next month, but I don't know that that can't be said about every single argument that is made in every single case. Let's cross that bridge when we come to it. I mean, that's all I can say, and you'll have to decide whether White, which can be directly applied here, should be expanded in the appropriate case where somebody comes back and suggests that White should be expanded. We're not suggesting any expansion of White whatsoever. In fact, like I say, we're saying that White controls this case a fortiori because we have even a less serious problem here because we actually had the sentencing under the appropriate sentencing provision or penalty provision. And I don't think that an argument about, what does that open the door to is a reason not to recognize what the present state of Wisconsin law is and to continue to apply it and to cross the bridge of whether it will be extended in another case. That's, like I say, always going to be the case about anything. There's always the question of how is it going to apply or will it be extended, and you can decide that when somebody asks for it to be extended. If there are no further questions. I will, yes.
There is. Justice Prosser.
As you were working on this case, did you take a look at 97126, formal defects? Did that ever cross your mind?
No, I don't think I did, and I'll let the court take a look at that back in chambers and decide whether that does have some application here.
Well, you think I
we have to look at the whole statute. There's some there's different time periods when amendments can be made and that kind of thing, right?
Says no indictment, information, complaint, or warrant shall be invalid, nor shall any trial, judgment, or other proceeding be affected by reason of any defect or imperfection in matters of form which do not prejudice the defendant. So the issue is whether this is form.
Yeah, it's A, whether it's form, and B, whether it prejudiced the defendant, which would again get back to whether the defendant really thought he was pleading to a 5.5 offense or whether his attorney had informed him that we really were down to the less than 5, because that's the penalty that I'm putting here on this plea questionnaire and for you. So it would be both a question of form, and it would also be a question, too, of whether the defendant was prejudiced. The defendant would obviously come back and say, I see my red light is on, and I guess I'll just stop.
Well, I have another question. 971081B says, before the court accepts a plea of guilty or no contest, it shall do all the following. And B is, make such inquiry as satisfies it that the defendant, in fact, committed the crime charged. And the issue here is that whether the court did so. But assuming that it didn't, then the position, I think, is whether or not, and you stated somewhat differently, whether the general harmless error issue comes in.
Well, except that I've never argued this is harmless error. I don't know whether I would, whether I'd want to, and I'm not so sure, given the state of harmless error these days, whether I would like to try and tackle that in a brief. But
come on, you can do it.
I've argued purely as a question of remedy. I mean, under White, I have, even though I said, where's the manifest injustice here, White says, in this kind of a situation, there is a manifest injustice and therefore agrees with Justice Bradley. But it says, wherein does the manifest injustice lie? And if it lies in the fact that there wasn't a factual basis for the penalty, then let's remedy that by resentencing him under the proper penalty. So I've never cast it as a harmless error argument. I would be reluctant to do it. It's a question of what's the remedy?
And your position is he's already gotten resentenced. He doesn't need
resentencing. He didn't even need resentencing. And maybe I should add one footnote to that, just in case there's any question about, well, did the judge, though, in sentencing, notwithstanding the fact that he had the right penalty range of up to 16 years, did he rely on the fact of 5.5? That was resolved at the post-conviction proceeding where the judge said, no, the 5.5 had nothing to do with my sentencing decision. So with that, I'll conclude.
You may be seated, Mr. Becker. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Vadsner.
Thank you. What I hear from what seems like the majority of the court is, what's the problem? They had the penalty right for the lesser offense, no prejudice, things were a little sloppy, big deal. Just to take a slight, what I think is really just a slight variation on what the facts are here is a hypothetical. We have the plea hearing, and the judge says, well, we've got an information here. It's a drug offense in Chapter 961, but it's sealed, and I can't tell you what it is, but I can tell you that the maximum penalty is 16 years. How do you plead? The defendant pleads no contest. We go to sentencing, bring out all kinds of information about the guy's past, and the judge says, you know, that thing is still sealed. I don't want to open it, but we're going to go ahead and sentence you with the maximum being 16, and hearing all this information, I'm going to give you 12 years. So now we're here in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and what we're saying is the appropriate remedy is to open it and then put that whatever that particular crime is, we're going to make sure that's on the judgment of conviction. And if it's on the judgment of conviction, everything's fixed. Mr. Becker characterized this case as hopelessly ambiguous. And in the course of his brief, he said, we don't know what charge Wright was pleading to. That's saying that the plea was not knowing and voluntary. Knowing and voluntary under the Bangert case that this court decided and has been cited hundreds and hundreds of times and you've refined in subsequent cases, says aside, one thing, yes, you have to know is the penalty, but you also have to know the elements. You have to know what it is that you're pleading to.
That's not the basis for your challenge to this plea, though.
That's the basis of Mr. Becker's defense of it, though. It's sort of like if I were up here saying there was an at a trial, there was an evidentiary deficiency, and therefore there should be a new trial, and the state comes in and says, well, there may have been an evidentiary error, but it was harmless because the evidence was insufficient anyway. So this didn't really matter because there was insufficient evidence to support the conviction. We just say, yeah, that makes sense to me. So, and you didn't argue insufficient evidence, so that's the end of the matter. What we have here is we're all focusing on the same set of circumstances. I put one label on it as lack of a factual basis. And the state's saying, no, there's no or I can't prove lack of a factual basis because we don't know what he pled to. Yeah, that may. Maybe that's a defense to my claim of lack of factual basis, but it's a defense that is basically conceding a related defect, because the state is essentially saying that the plea was no good because we never specified what the elements were. This idea of prejudice is something that doesn't apply to that. The Johnson case that Justice Sykes referred to as one, and I think an even better example, and I discussed them both together in my brief, is the West case, where the Court of Appeals reversed the conviction or said there was no factual basis for a plea for conspiracy to commit insurance fraud. And in that case, what the Court said is there was no conspiracy. There may have been insurance fraud, but it wasn't conspiracy for insurance fraud. And therefore, they invalidated the plea. Now, you can't really say there was any prejudice. They had the penalty right in that case. But when you're not going to trial, as Chief Justice Abrahamson noted, the judge is required to establish the factual basis for the plea. That did not happen in this case. What Mr. Becker is really saying is, I can't prove a lack of a factual basis because we don't know what he pled to. But that doesn't cure the problem. It's just simply stating the same problem in a different way. The traditional approach in these situations is to withdraw the plea.
Counselor, what benefit do you hope to get for your client?
Well, that's one of the points that I tried to make previously in this argument and in my brief, that I think that many clients in Mr. Wright's position would not want to withdraw their plea. He's potentially going to wind up much worse off.
Well, that answer my question, then. What benefit? You're not here telling us that you're trying to hurt your client. What benefit are you trying to get for your client by putting all of us through all this?
Well, I'm putting everybody through this because that's what this particular client wanted to do, and I believe under the controlling law that he's entitled to it. I think it's ironic that this case came to this court with a theory that maybe we all think is a little off, but a waiver theory that the Court of Appeals came up with the idea of simplifying the law and eliminating the number of challenges to guilty pleas. What I'm submitting in conclusion is that if you adopt the state's position, what you're really going to be doing is encouraging defendants to challenge the guilty plea, because ordinarily a remedy of resentencing is more beneficial to the defendant than withdrawing the plea. And also in terms of this whole White analysis, we're also going to be making the process much more complicated because it's going to be necessary in each one of these cases to determine whether or not the absence of the factual basis relates to the so-called core offense or whether or not it relates to a penalty factor. I believe that this is a very unusual case. It's not a very good case to make law. The law in this area is well established when there's no factual basis or where the plea is not knowing and voluntary because we don't know what the charges were. The remedy is to allow the defendant to withdraw the plea, whether it's a good idea or not. That's what he chose to do. It's my problem. It's his problem. Your responsibility should be to follow the law, and that's what the law is. This is not a good case to change the law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Betzner, and thank you, Mr. Becker, for your arguments today. And once again, taking pleas. That concludes our discussion of 02-3348 CR State versus Wright. We'll call the next case, but the court will take a few moments in recess, so those students who wish to leave may do so because the Pre-Law Society of Whitewater is coming in.
Thank you.